This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie. This podcast, recorded at the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in March of 2007, features Paul Bowman talking about his research into the early Irish socialist writer William Thompson. You can find out more about Thompson at www.wsm.ie/Thompson.
How many people have heard of William Thompson before? No? Right, some of these have notes. Some of them. Okay. Some people have heard of him, some people not. I'm going to do a brief introduction, sort of biography to him, just to give you some kind of background as to who he was. What I really want to talk about are some of his ideas, particularly because I don't want to just present him as a historical figure, because I think he's someone that, although he died back in 1833, some of his ideas can still be used by us today as ways of criticizing capitalism, economics, stuff like that. So, but I will start with a brief idea of who he was. William Thompson was born in Cork City 1775. He comes from a Anglo-Protestant ascendancy type family. His father was a merchant, relatively prosperous merchant in Cork City, involved in shipping and such like. Thompson is born into a life where he's going to be a merchant, but he's not going to have to work with his hands or stuff like that. They have a relatively large amount of money. They become landowners later on in 1806. However, his life is one where he's actually turns his back on what he calls being one of the idle classes. The society of sort of that he sees around him in Cork at that time is one very much of a small minority of very wealthy people who live in a life of quite luxury and so on and so forth, and a large mass of ordinary people on the brink of extreme poverty and starvation almost in cases when times are hard. And his whole life really is a moral rejection of that. As I say, he's born in 1775, around the time of the American Revolution. In 1789, he's 14 years old as the French Revolution breaks out. He becomes a supporter of the ideals of the French Revolution, as many of sort of the upper classes of Britain and the ascendancy in Ireland were at the time, of the liberal wing, if you like, of the upper classes. In 1791, when the United Irishmen are formed, he's actually only 16 years old, so he probably had no opportunity to have any interaction with those people directly, although he would have moved in the same circles within Cork of the people that were involved in discussing the ideas of republicanism, of the American and French variety that the United Irishmen talked about. 1793, Godwin's Political Justice is published. Britain declares war on the French Revolution. The United Irishmen are banned. This time he's 18 years old. 1794, his father, John Thompson, becomes the Lord Mayor of Cork. So that's an indication of the kind of connectedness of sort of the ruling class, if you like, that his father's involved with. 1798 is, of course, the year of the United Irishmen uprising. It's been preceded by 2 years of the penal laws of great provocation and brutality by the British ruling powers. In Cork, in the county Cork, there is actually an abortive uprising just outside of Clonakilty, which is not very far at all from where William Thompson's land is, in fact. So, although there was no way he would have had anything to do with that uprising, the aftermath of it that it brought, both in terms of Cork and nationally, of course, throughout the country, there's of people being killed, and the savagery of the backlash from the British establishment has got to be one of the formative sort of experiences of his young life, 23. The next year, in fact, there is the local powers that be in Cork, including his father, gets together and forms something called the Cork Society for Bettering the Condition of the Poor, which is obviously an attempt of the powers that be to say, like, we need to do something about these, the poor, basically, A, because we're scared of them, but B, because we, you know, the situation is intolerable. So it's an indication of the idea that even in while the repression is still going on, there's some of the more enlightened, if you can call them that, aspects of the upper class are saying, like, we have to do something about the desperation of the people's things. Followed, of course, by the Act of Union 1800. Now, in 1814, I'll skip ahead a little bit, John Thompson dies and William inherits the family firm. He inherits also the lands at Parhugarif, which is a sort of an area of fairly rough, boggy land just above the harbour in Glandore in West Cork, which he, rather than being the traditional absentee landlord, he actually goes and spends a fair amount of time staying on that land and interacting with his tenant farmers and attempting to pass on improvements in agricultural techniques and so on, and doing some work establishing a school for the infants and stuff like that, and doing things that landlords did not normally do in West Cork, and actually taking an active interest in trying to better the condition of his tenants. 1818, he's involved in a political battle around the Cork Institute. The Cork Institute is something that was set up in 1806 or thereabouts, which is given a grant from the British Parliament as something to educate the local people. The battle that Thompson gets into, because he's one of the proprietors of the Institute, is with the other members of the Institute, because he feels that they're using this money, which is supposedly for the education and betterment of the local people, has just been turned into an exclusive club for the lecturers for the amusement of the upper classes and well-to-do in Cork. It's a battle he fights within the papers of the Cork Southern Recorder for about a year, and eventually loses. But it certainly informed his opinions very much of the fact that you couldn't rely on the goodwill, the benevolence, if you like, of the upper classes in terms of doing anything worthwhile in terms of bettering the poor. 1819, we have the Peterloo Massacre in Britain, again, the crackdown. Sorry, I should mention, in 1815, after Waterloo, you have a whole period of 20 years of war on the continent, which has been the backbone to the whole economy, both in Britain and in Ireland. The wars end, which means you have a mass release of people from the army. You have the economy itself, which has been built up feeding the war, collapses, and you have a period from 1815 really until 1820 of total crisis, basically. Mass unemployment, terrible poverty, people people starving. And accompanied, of course, with massive social struggle. So it's a scary time for all sorts of people. 1820, you have the Cato Street Conspiracy, further repression, etc. I missed out the Robert Emmet Rebellion in 1803. Robert Emmet would have been someone, again, he's the same age, roughly within 3 years of William Thompson. Similar background to Thompson, he's a Cork Protestant ascendancy, pro-Republican minded fellow. He would have, it's almost certain that they would have moved in the same circles and would have known each other. So by the early 1820s comes, Thompson is very much wanting to improve the condition of the poor and so on and so forth. He's coming from the background of the failure and the repression that's followed the direct uprising attempts and so on. He's very publicly declaring himself, I'm a pacifist, I want to make change through peaceful means, because we've tried uprisings and frankly the outcomes have been bloody and have failed. He's annoyed by a speaker on political economy, comes to speak at the Cork Institute and says, it's the whole point of political economy is to prove what a good thing it is that you have this economic inequality, and is attacking America for being far too equal. They're poor people, just are not poor enough. Thompson's absolutely outraged by this, and apart from attacking the fellow and thing, decides that he needs to go off and study the science of political economy which is being used more and more by social commentators to justify the most outrageous sort of tactics by the British Parliament, by the rising industrial bourgeoisie, and particularly by the followers of Thomas Malthus, who is arguing that, you know, if you give an extra penny to the poor, then any extra income they use, they will just breathe until there's more of them, and they'll starve again. So basically anybody who's advocating so the poor should be allowed to form trade unions, or combinations as they've been called, to fight for a better wage is just condemning them for millions starving in the future. And this is, yes. So Thomas goes in and begins this research on political economy, during which time he travels to England. He meets utilitarians like Jeremy Bentham and so on. And while he's there in 1822, he meets Robert Owen, who's sort of this Welsh self-made industrious who's running a mill in New Lanark, and is sort of one of the proposers of a plan for the poor to form communities where they will farm their own land, be more or less economically self-sufficient, but hold property in common. Thomas is starting from his critique of political economies in a classic sort of Benthamite utilitarian vein, and confronted with the ideas of Robert Owen, he initially goes, well, no, this whole idea of communism is nonsense. The best thing we could do is to have an ideal system of exchange, but free from, you know, from the taxes and tithes and from the monopoly of the means of production that currently exists. But confronted by Robert Owen's ideas, he gradually becomes a convert. And the book that he produced in 1824, which is an inquiry considering the principles governing the distribution of wealth, as the title goes on and on and on, he is actually noted by Max Netlau, who's the historian of the anarchist movement, as being one where you can actually see someone being converting themselves from having a quite traditional liberal critique of political economy to actually becoming the world's first libertarian communist, which is where my interest comes into. with Thomson. Now, as I say, I'm going to move on to the ideas fairly shortly. He is, at the time, he becomes involved in the cooperative movement while Owen is in America doing his thing at New Harmony. Becomes a leading speaker for the cooperative movement, has the Chancery Lane debates with the political economists led by John Stuart Mill, who actually defeats him, because he has quite a strong influence on Stuart Mill later on in his life. While basically becomes sort of the leader of a large part of the cooperative movement, who in order to distinguish themselves from the ideas of Robert Owen, who tends to be a person who's going around trying to get governments and rich people to buy into schemes, they're very much more in favour of working class autonomy, that people need to be able to find their own communities themselves. Rather than call themselves Owenites, they use this term that Thomson's introduced, this idea of social science, which he introduces in the inquiry, and they call themselves socialists. And that's actually the origin of the word socialist, is the fallenness of William Thomson in the cooperative movement. So the father of socialism comes from court, basically. He's also a feminist, and the year after his inquiry, he publishes the first book written in defense of women's rights and feminism. We call it An Appeal on Behalf of One Half of Humanity to the Other Half, blah, blah, blah. Another one, with 1870 times, goes on and on and on. Dolores Dooley is an academic down at Cork University, and has published this book, which is one of the few still in print available, about the ideas of Thomson. And Anna Wheeler, who is someone he also meets in 1822, who becomes very important in development of his ideas, both on feminism and both in terms of networking him with people like Owen and some of the people in France as well. He's also involved in, back in Ireland, he's involved in supporting the struggle for Catholic emancipation. He's sort of, he's on the board of the local branch of the organization that O'Connell forms for, emancipation, repeal of the union, things like this, and is in general in support of, obviously, as you know, the movement for reform, for democracy, things like that. All around, you know, he's more or less on the right side on most things. But he's suffered all his life through bad health, through sort of bronchial asthma type thing, and just as things are getting interesting in the late 1820s and early 1830s, where you're having a series of big cooperative movement congresses in Britain, Owen's come back from the States, and there's a bit of a conflict between Thompson and his supporters and Owen. He just thinks that he owns the movement. He's sort of dictatorial, wisely slightly to the right of Joseph Stalin, was Robert Owen, unfortunately. But sadly for Thompson, he does not survive, and he dies in by 1833. Owen, of course, continues to go on for another 20 years, which is why he's able to rewrite history and, if you like, still define the movement that, for many people, you know, they still see that movement as Owenism, although, as I say, at the time in the 1820s and 1830s, it was really Thompson's ideas that were making the run. Right. I'd say, again, Dolores' book is extremely useful on the background of the history and the ideas. So what I'm going to do is take you through the turning point, if you like, that Thompson went through in his movement from a sort of a liberal, we can reform commerce and exchange and so on, to make it, to remove all the imperfections and to make, you know, for a fairer society, and his actual conversion to communism. And the way he does this is, in the first few chapters of the Inquiry, he creates this idea of how you can have a reformed system of exchange and so on and so forth. And then he gets to the end of that and he asks himself the question, but given that's the fairest that we can make society of exchange, is there another system of distribution that would actually be fairer or would produce more happiness? Because he's judging everything on, like, we need to determine sort of what system of distribution of wealth is going to bring the greatest happiness for the greatest number. He finds that there are five main points that are wrong with the idea of exchange, even the fairest system of exchange. The first one, is the most important one, is retains the principle of selfishness. In any exchange situation, we can make it equal is the best thing we can do, but obviously it's in my interest that it's unequal or in my favor. And that principle goes throughout society, and it's inherent in the system of exchange. One, it retains the principle of selfishness, necessarily warring with the principle of benevolence as a leading motive to action in all the ordinary affairs of life. The second problem is, two, it paralyzes productive powers as to wealth of one half of the human race, women, by the waste and other misuse of individual family arrangements, and renders difficult, if not impossible, that equalization of rights and duties between the sexes, which is necessary for the equal enjoyment of the greatest happiness as well. Three, it occasionally leads to unprofitable or injudicious modes of individual exertion from the limited field judgment open to individual minds. Four, it affords no adequate, no unobjectionable resource for sickness, old age, malformation, and other accidents incident to human life. And five, it obstructs the progress of useful physical and moral education by prejudice and despotism and continued domestic control, rendered overwhelming light by command of individual property. And it also obstructs the progress of general knowledge from the necessity of concealment in order to render prudence of science and art tributary, science and art tributary to an individual gain. So what I'm going to quickly do is sort of rearrange those into the basic one they commented. Thing about keeping women dependent, obviously this is in a pre-welfare state mode where people, where women are the chattel of husbands. They have no independent income or property even, get over children. If we rearrange these, we'd actually get two sort of three main areas, and we'll come on to that one in a minute. One is the dependency issue. Now, to a certain extent, that has been addressed by social democracy and the emergence of a welfare state, something obviously that people have had to fight for. But nonetheless, the second one which he's talking about is this idea of people going around and, you know, three people in three different towns deciding to set up the same factory, create the same thing, due to a lack of communication, lack of market intelligence, if you like. The third one is possibly the most important one, which is what I call productivity paradox, which is where you have an improvement in productivity in any particular field because of the system of exchange. It's in whoever interest discovers the improvement or method of improved productivity to try and conceal that from the rest of society rather than spreading it. Because if I become better at my job, then that gives me advantage over you if you're doing it in the same job. If I teach you how to be as good as myself, then I've lost that advantage. So by the very token of that, I'm exchanging my labor or the products of my labor for a share of the social wealth. We're necessarily at war with one another and not. I'm trying to maximize my personal gain, and so are you, but that means that if we actually collaborated and to produce as much as possible, we would all gain, but within a system of exchange. That doesn't work, that's productivity paradox. And the fourth issue is something that comes up in his debates with Thomas Hobsbawm in the Mechanics Institutes back in the 1820s, which is the problem of where you have, in most most production nowadays, you have a collective of people producing the same service or the same product. And the question is, how do you divide up who is responsible for which share of that product? You know, I go to work, I work as an IT person now. What share of my eventual product is due to my work, to the teacher that taught me how to read and write, to the people that write the computer software that I work with, to the person that cleans my office? You know, how do we break down these things and divide? And that's a very important issue, which is the main one that Kropotkin, for example, takes away and develops and runs with as his basis in the wage system and so on of why collectivism, this idea that we can have common property in means of production, but not common property in the actual products, is a non-starter. Now, it's normal that Kropotkin would focus on that issue because that's one very much to do with justice, with the injustice of the wage system, if you like. One of the things that Thompson discovered in his, because he starts off obviously from an ethical political critique of the system of exchange, and he discovers to his surprise that there's actually things that are wrong with it that make it inefficient. That in a sense it would be more efficient. We'd get more stuff done in less time if we actually had, were not controlled by the relations of exchange the way that it sets us against each other. And that's actually quite interesting because one of the biggest breakthroughs, you know, now today of the emergence of a small area of communist production is, of course, the production of free software. And that's actually come through by a number of people who are not committed communists by any means whatsoever. In fact, many of them are good red-blooded American commie-hating people. But they've ended up using that method of approach because it's efficient. You know, it has allowed a sort of a network, a loose network of people who've never met all around the world to create a competing product to what Bill Gates, the richest man in the world's company, has produced in their spare time for no money. And that's an element of, it's something that has got traditional economists scratching their head on, why on earth, how can this happen? You know, this does not fit in our economic models whatsoever. So I'm really out of time, but that's why I was saying Thompson's critique, the thing that he discovered of this, what's wrong with the society of exchange, is still has relevance for us today. It particularly has relevance for us because it's what I would call a molecular critique of communism, whereas Marx's is a molar critique. That is to say, Marx is the critique of how capitalism works in large masses in sort of class versus class idea. Whereas Thompson's, because he's starting from a society that isn't, you know, that isn't a big factory developed factory society, whereas a society of small producers, and so on. He starts off with this kind of Proudhonian sort of scheme of a bourgeois, petty bourgeois sort of artisanal idea of, you know, everyone is going to be their own self-employed producer in exchange, blah, blah, blah. Comes this molecular, small, individual Asian understanding of the problems of exchange, which is quite important because in Marx's sort of plan of what comes after capitalism, he said, well, we'll go through a first stage where, you know, everybody will get paid according to the labor they produce, which is a mistake that Thompson certainly wouldn't make. And that when he was having this war within the cooperative movement with Robert Owen, Owen came back from the collapse of his attempts to establish a community in the States and goes, right, we set up something called the National Equitable Labor Exchange Scheme, whereas workers are going to come in and exchange their artists in particular, are going to exchange their products on the basis of these labor notes, which we're going to print up. And Thomas going, no, that's not going to work, guys. That's quite important as well because people are still producing the same ideas today. We have these Calgary dollars, things which are out there. In Germany, we have these regional currency schemes. And these whole sort of wonderful, we'll print up labor notes or labor exchange trading schemes, they are. And these sort of Proudhonian ideas that we can find a way to fix exchange and these ideas of a way to fix the credit system, like the Grameen Bank got sort of the Nobel Prize or whatever the hell it was they got last year. The Grameen Bank, which is the microcredit system. So we still have a lot of these ideas out there, people, like we can find ways to fiddle with the exchange system and with the credit system, you know, to find our way to a better world. Because their understanding, their critique of capitalist economics is still quite weak, and is still played with ideas that, you know, sort of we've been trying to fight against since the 1820s, really. Right. I've managed to transcribe some of Thompson's work, and we're going to get it up on the website, I believe, including sort of the crucial fifth chapter where he does this transition, so you can read some of this stuff for yourself. His introduction to the Inquirer as well, so you can have a read of this stuff. And I will write some of this up because I know there's just way too much information here to go through. But I'm going to shut up now for a minute and see if anybody's got any questions.
This podcast, recorded at the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in March of 2007, features Paul Bowman talking about his research into the early Irish socialist writer William Thompson. You can find out more about Thompson at www.wsm.ie/Thompson.
It'll
be on the WSM one, so wsm.ie/Thompson.
What I intend to do is actually to get Thompson's stuff digitized and actually up on the web because we don't need to kill any more trees. Like the Inquirer is 600 fucking pages. And also, it's a lot easier to go through with the help of a search engine where you can look for the bits you're interested in. So that's something I hope to do to make his stuff more accessible.
So, let's go to questions. Let's take a stock question. Do you want to get the stock question stocked or defer to each?
Go ahead.
Just before a question, I was going to ask, how come Thompson, a figure of such social stature, had no connection with the national movement as it was, but you really answered it, and he was involved with O'Connell, and it's probably a factor of the way we were taught history that we were never taught in the departments. As Thompson, of course, O'Connell would have overshadowed most of the other people involved. But the question was going to get Connolly calls him for one of Marx. I know he claims that he was made by their labour theory of value of values. Is there something in that?
That's been a little bit overdone. He did introduce the term surplus value into the English language, let's say, along with socialism and social science. These are his introductions. His theory of value is a little bit weaker because he's part of a number of people, including people like Thomas Hodgkin, John Gray, John Francis Bray, and so on, whose main influence from political economy is Adam Smith rather than Ricardo. And it's Engels, who, on looking back on them sort of in the 1880s, who makes a mistake saying that because Ricardo published his work there, they must be familiar with it, therefore they're what's called Ricardian socialists. Actually, they're not. There's a guy called Noel Thompson who wrote a fairly good book on this called The People's Science, which is not just about Thompson, but about the whole development of the workers and sort of socialist movement realizing that they needed to answer the way political economy was being used to attack them. I mean, and by the way, economics is still used to attack our movement today. I mean, that's why this stuff is so relevant, because, you know, political economy, although they try and claim it's not political these days, is still the theology of the bosses and justifying what they're doing to us. So, yeah, his value theory isn't particularly that well developed, and one of the interesting things is when he gets into the debate with Hodgkin, he actually moves away from it altogether, because they get into this thing. Hodgkin publishes a book called Labor Defended, and just anonymously just titled himself Labor. And Thompson picks him up on this and says, well, you know, I don't claim to be a member, I've always claimed to be a member of the idle classes. Says, but to be honest, fella, you're a journalist. You know, you're saying that anybody who doesn't create wealth with their hands, and this is back in classical political economy where wealth is physical, tangible objects. And Thompson goes into this whole thing and says, well, you know, by that token, you're not really a physical laborer. You're a mental laborer. And he opens up the whole topic of what is nowadays called immaterial labor, which has been around for a while, long, you know, before Marx started, and is still quite an important debate amongst sort of the post-autonomia crowd, like Lazzarato, Negri, and people like that. So he moves a little bit away, really, from a classical political economy, and in many ways, he's saying, well, the value of the thing, to a certain extent, is you know, what we, the consumers, consider its utility to us. And in many ways, he's opening up what becomes, later on, under Jevons and Marshall, becomes the neo neoclassical critique, or the Marshallist revolution in some ways. So he's influenced Marx. Marx is also quite strongly influenced by Hodgkin as well, though. But it's too much to say that his theory of value is
a kind of
Marx. Yes, Marx it certainly makes reference to him in Poverty of Philosophy back in the 1840s. It's likely, though, unfortunately, Marx will have read the bowdlerized abbreviated version of his works after Thompson died. I should have mentioned this, Jesus Christ. When he died, Thompson willed his entire estate to the cooperative movement to use, and to the tenants to use to found a community on. And his surviving family, his sisters in fact, took his will to the court and fought a battle for 25 years. Which is, I think, is officially the longest battle in what would have been at the time British legal history, to get the will annulled on the grounds that he must be obviously crazy. For another class person to give away the means of production to the lower orders was insane. And they didn't really win, the lawyers won in the end, because they sucked it all away. Yeah, sorry.
Thanks.
I think he probably suffered from dying relatively young, and that Marx had the advantage of living on and being constantly able to revise what he was doing and saying. I'm sure that he's confused most of us for generations since. But I just wanted to mention, you know, the dealings with Owen and certainly there were problems with them. How much of an influence was the political activity, do you think? You know, the Chartists movement, at least what was going on in terms of trying to appeal for the franchise, and that more strictly political movement that was happening in Britain, as opposed to what was political, obviously, in Ireland, but was focused around Catholic emancipation.
Yeah, first one of his sort of good friends and comrades when he's in this struggle with Owen within a conversation is a guy called William Lovett going in to write the People's Charter. But obviously, People's Charter isn't written in 1838, by which time Thompson's been dead for 7 years. It'll be fascinating to know where he would have developed. What's so impressive about Thompson is he starts off from 1824 when he publishes his first book. until when he dies 9 years later. He did so much in just those 9 years. I mean, I don't know about yourself, but, you know, 9 years to me has just gone. I got out of bed and then 9 years had gone. So to actually achieve so much, to have released four books, you know, the Inquiry itself, The Appeal, and The Defense of Feminism, Labor, rewarded his reply to Hodgkin's sort of play, and his final one, which is Practical Directions for the Speedy Construction of a Community, which is an amazing book, really. It's everything down to, like, right, we get the tax from here, and we'll ward in the eye from so-and-so, a whole DIY, build-yourself community kit, basically, because someone go like, well, we have all these ideas, we don't know how to do it, so we went away and wrote books, and like, we're going to do it like this, which is a little bit over the top, but it's his practical nature as well, which really comes into it, but also mixed up with his, well, why we need to do this, which is that we can't create, you know, we need to create an example, a working example, an experiment in communism, you know, because words are cheap. And unless we're never going to achieve anything unless we're doing the engineering way by experimenting, by creating actual realities on the ground that people can look at. Because otherwise we're just, you know, having meetings and creating speeches.
The risk of sounding like a devil's advocate was not, to some extent, what Olin was doing. You know, on a smaller scale, in the sense that it was confined to the workplace, but, you know, in his perfect factories.
It was partly what Owen proposed, although there's a slight difference. Owen's plan was that basically at the center of this community would be a big watchtower where the person in charge, like him, would be running everything. And it's good. Thompson's plan is quite noticeable by the fact that there's no central watchtower, anybody in the middle, and that when the Congress in 1822, when sort of they're at the height of Moon Tower's forming community, someone proposes, we form a community on the basis of these practical directions, and that Thompson be in charge, and he turns around and goes, hell no, no way am I going to be in charge. And that's a feature all the way through his life, that although obviously he predates the anarchist movement, and he shies away from, you know, coming out and saying things like, rise up and smash the state, partly because of his background of sort of the slaughter of 1798 and the end of the rebellion and stuff like that. And partly because you just couldn't say that without, you know, being slung in jail, basically. Although it is noticeable that in 1830, when news of the French Orleanist revolution comes through, he's actually reporting the press is saying, well, you know, this is the kind of revolution that we need to push forward in this country. And of course the leaders of the media go, whoa, you can't say that. So he wasn't quite as against revolution as sometimes made out, but yeah, it's a matter of time.
Just a general question about from your honesty and your interest in economics. How to assume you guys, economics is a great weakness on the certainly on the Irish left. It's always been a weak point. How important do you think it is to engage with voter economics? Well, we get a constant stream, so especially in recent times.
Do
we just say, well, we know a different way of doing it, we just plug on, or should we engage publicly in the media answering specific points? Should we get into that?
One of the reasons why I'm interested in Thompson is that the anarchist movement in general has been extremely weak on critique of political economy. At the time of the first split in the First International, the anarchist movement were like, well, we agree with Marx's critique. You know, the capital is translated into Italian by Carlo Caffiero, Bakunin takes the money but doesn't translate capital into Russian. And James Guillaume, one of the Swiss anarchists at the time of the split, says, well, he slags off the people who are backing Marx in London, saying, like, well, we've read Marx's Capital and we agree with it. That doesn't mean we back Marx. And he says, and the people who back Marx, they haven't read Capital. You know, how the hell can they be Marxists? But so the problem is the anarchist movement has always had this tendency to slightly outsource the critique of political economy. Goes, well, Capital works, we'll just use that.
And that's why I'm interested in Thompson, because, like I say, he's coming at it from a slightly different angle, and he's revealing things that aren't immediately obvious from Marx's sort of value-based critique. And so I do think that the movement as a whole, politically, we do have to come up with a new critique of political economy, and it has to be one that deals with, you know, today's political economy as well. Both to get away from, you know, silly ideas that we think are not going to work, like, you know, microcredit, the Grameen Bank, and local labor exchange notes and things like that, which, you know, they, in 180 years, they haven't freed us, so why should it start freeing us now? But yeah, I think we have to go away and do the work. I also think it's kind of up to the anarchist movement to do it as well, because one of the problems of being a Marxist movement is it's very difficult to get away from Marx when you're called a Marxist. And most Marxists do tend to, they try and elaborate the critique of political economy, but they keep collapsing back onto what Marx said. And we do have to move on, unfortunately. You know, but lots of work to do, yeah.
This podcast, recorded at the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in March of 2007, features Paul Bowman talking about his research into the early Irish socialist writer William Thompson. You can find out more about Thompson at www.wsm.ie/Thompson. This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie.